We shall have a most unusual TNT this week, as Lord Alfred Hayes stated. A number of unsung heroes, some of which are in a rookie status, others are certainly veterans, but it is those individuals which we will key on this week and hear their story, as opposed to the normal aspect here on TNT.
Doc, I'm from the future. I came here in a time machine that you invented. Now I need your help to get back to the year 1985.
From Television City in Hollywood.
This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
The following rustic exhibition requires discretionary viewer participation.
Greetings from Allentown is taped in front of a live studio audience.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 150 of Greetings from Allentown. I am your host, Peter Winsome. And as you can tell from the music that's playing under me, the soothing overdub of the WWE Network, or is it WWE Classics on Demand, which is where I got this edition from, because there's two different overdubs of the TNT Tuesday Night Titans theme. And for this show, I'm going to be looking at the May 3rd, 1985 edition. You can figure out it was 1985 from that thing that I throw in at the top. That's going to be a new, regular, recurring thing. Anytime I do a show from 1985, I'm throwing in the Marty McFly asking Doc Brown for his help getting back to 1985. It certainly makes a lot of sense. But this is one of my favorite episodes of TNT. It is the one with, as Vince talked about, the unsung heroes, which you may call them enhancement talents, you may call them jobbers, but it's certainly a very interesting scene where you got nine different guys on this show who ordinarily wouldn't be there. I think a guy like Pete Doherty might have been on in a different capacity at another time. Paul Roma might have been on at another point. But it's certainly interesting to hear from dudes like Rusty Brooks. And oh boy, do we hear from Rusty Brooks in the show. This is going to be the Rusty Brooks show. I mean, you thought episode 19, where he was facing Hulk Hogan, or was it episode 17? Whatever it was, he's facing Hulk Hogan in that one later in 85. This is going to be the episode that cements Rusty Brooks as a Greetings from Allentown first ballot Hall of Famer. I probably should have a Hall of Fame ceremony. But before I go any further, let me get in my plugs. You can email the show, greetingsfromallentown@gmail.com, facebook.com/greetingsfromallentown. Yes, I said that correct. Give me a follow on Twitter at GF Allentown Pod. That is at GF Allentown Pod. And you may be listening to the show on the Pro Wrestling Only feed. And you can check out all the other great shows on here, such as Bigfoot Pro Wrestling Podcast, looking at independent wrestling from the Pacific Northwest. And you got Strong Style Story, which there's definitely going to be a Strong Style. I haven't asked yet. But considering you got two Wrestle Kingdom shows over the weekend, which I think is a pretty novel idea, and I always think of, well, why don't they just make this 8.5-hour monstrosity WrestleMania? Why don't you just make it over 2 days? That way, you get to use the stage setup two consecutive days. You get two gates out of it. A lot of the people who are going there are probably going to go to both of them anyway. And I know you're going to burn out the crowd. Like, yeah, well, you burn out the crowd with an 8-hour show. So, you know, one way or the other. And, of course, Days of Thunder, looking at WCW Thunder right now in the middle of 1998. As for Wrestle Kingdom this past weekend, I didn't see any of it. I don't really pay too much attention to it on Twitter, and I'm kind of glad that I don't, because the pictures of Chris Jericho really bothered me. Here, I am a person who came out of gallbladder surgery last week, who hurt his knee, and more on that in a little bit, and yet I still think I look better than Chris Jericho without my shirt on. I don't, maybe I just have an inflated opinion of myself, but could somebody get him one of those shirts that The Rock wore in 98-99 when he had that titty surgery because he took too many steroids before that and was going to... Well, you know, you can look all that up. I really don't want to go down that road. So, yeah, you're not going to get a lot of Japanese wrestling here from me, but, you know, you can debate Okada. Is he the greatest of all time? My opinion is probably not, even though I haven't seen all of his matches, because even if you're just talking about guys right now, Daniel Bryan is still a thing that exists, and Daniel Bryan does pretty much everything well, and that's just kind of the way that I look at it. So why don't I go back to more of my comfort zone in the past? But first, I owe you an update. This is good that I don't have to talk about football, because the absolute embarrassment that was Vinny Vegas Corner that I posted on Twitter, where I went 0 for 4 on my picks. Now, it did seem a lot of the games were kind of, you know, run out of the bizarro world. Certainly don't expect the Patriots to lose at home, and you don't expect the Saints to lose at home the way that they did. But you know, I just got to put football out of my mind. In fact, maybe I should just tank my picks the rest of the playoffs and try to go 0-11. But I probably owe you a medical update on myself, considering the fact that I recorded the show last week on Sunday so that I could get it all in before my surgery. And I left that 2-minute window pretty early on, about 13 minutes in, where I could just weigh in after the surgery. And the anesthetic hit me kind of hard because it's something that I've never had before. So I did kind of sound out of it. I sounded a little bit like Chris Traeger, a.k.a. you know, Rob Lowe from Parks and Rec in that great flu episode.
I vomited somewhere in this room. I don't remember where, though. Wait, you might want to check that drawer. Stop pooping.
I probably should have gotten in contact with the hospital to negotiate a lower bill in exchange for, like, a sponsored segment on the, like, the Pete Medical Update, sponsored by Lowell General Hospital, the place that did Ahmed Johnson's splenectomy from 1997 after the Thursday Raw Thursday. Well, I know technically it was Saints Hospital, but it's all under the Lowell General Hospital umbrella. So, my incision scars are healing quite well. It does not hurt as much when I cough, which was a cough that I got because when I went to work on the 27th, the person that I share an office with decided to come in and cough every 15 seconds for a span of 6 hours. It was particularly annoying. So that's all done. I'm still on a bland diet. However, there's also the matter of my knee injury, for which I went to the doctor twice last week on New Year's Eve, and then also the January 2nd, which under two different insurance regimes, but medical insurance in the United States, a whole different conversation. So this doctor gave me what I guess is known as the McMurray test, which is not to be confused with the McFlurry test. But this is basically you stand on your bad leg and you test the range of motion. You can kind of tell based on where everything hurts. Now, I had a knee immobilizer and I was walking with a cane at the time, and he advised me to walk on it. Yes, ice it every so often, but walking on it will help me regain a range of motion. I still have not had an MRI. However, the doctor, based on the McMurray test, said that he believes that I have a torn meniscus, which can be a something that can be managed. So I went out onto Amazon.com and ordered myself a couple of knee braces. Now, this does not mean I am going to turn in to Stone Cold Steve Austin circa, I don't know, 2001 through 2003, where he basically had, not to make another Ahmed Johnson reference, where he had like more knee braces than Ahmed Johnson had like knee pads on his legs. It just was out of control. I'm not going to go out and get jean shorts and wear a knee brace below it. I'm just going to kind of hide it underneath my pants, even though one of my friends said, well, people will cut you a break if you have the brace on top of your pants, but I really don't want to sport that look. I also had a conversation with Keithy, the voice of Greetings from Allentown, where he explained to me the concept of jackies. I had never heard this before in my life. Apparently, they are khakis that are colored to look like jeans. I don't know much about it, and I looked it up, and I couldn't find anything. I'm pretty sure that that's something you can find on a rack at Kohl's, I would imagine, or perhaps Marshall's or TJ Maxx, or maybe you've never heard of these stores, so perhaps I should just move on. But the bottom line is now that I can actually move around fairly decently with the knee brace sleeve that I purchased for $13, which was an easy purchase to make given that I won $100 in Amazon gift cards as part of my fairly low-stakes NFL wins pool. Now a three-time champion of that, 2013, 2017, and 2019, which sounds impressive, but it's a five-person league. So I think I'm on the mend, except I'm having a biopsy on Friday, which sounds way worse than it is. It's going to prove to be nothing, but hey, you know, I'm not going to freak out about it like George Costanza. If I've learned anything from these past few weeks, it's to enjoy life while you're healthy, because before you know it, you're going to be 81 years old and you're not going to be able to move anywhere. It's not worth getting into these petty, stupid arguments on social media that nobody will remember in like 2 days. So, you know, go out there and enjoy life, you know, while it doesn't hurt to cough and all any manner of thing. I just look forward to coming out of my self-imposed Chinese food retirement, I guess semi-retirement, there's that word again, at Kowloon, New England's premier Asian dining experience tomorrow night. As this show drops, I'm going to be there on Friday night, so that'll be nice. It'd be great if I could just do comedy there, but they wouldn't have the likes of me there. They had Mick Foley there, but you know, he's kind of got an established show. But anyway, back to the whole wrestling part of it, because I am very excited to do this episode of TNT. It's been on my list for very long time. This is something that I watched on the network shortly after they posted it. I want to say it was back in 2014 when they did post the TNTs, and you know, in going through them, it was a matter of curiosity because it was stuff that I hadn't seen before. And I said on the earlier TNT that I did, episode 30, which is one of my all-time favorite episodes of Greetings from Allentown that I've ever done, where Tony Garea gets into the bar fight with Terry Funk at the end of the show. There's three distinct eras of TNT. There's the first 6 months. It comes on the air end of May 84, and it's not good for that first 5-6 months because it's a two-hour show. It's just way too long for what they were trying to accomplish. I know, a WWEF program on the USA Network that lasted an hour too long. So 85 rolls around, they shorten it to an hour. It's no longer on Tuesday, so you just hear it referred to as TNT, even though the name is still formally Tuesday Night Titans. 85, I think, is when it really hits its stride. There's a lot of fun stuff through the year, which is why anytime I cover this show, it'll probably be something from that year. And as you roll into 86, it almost feels like they had accomplished what they set out to accomplish with this show, kind of bringing out the personalities of the wrestlers. And by the end, the last 12 or 13 episodes, Mean Gene Okerlund is behind the desk. He does not do a bad job, but the show was done for at that point. It wouldn't have mattered what Mean Gene had done. I mean, he could have juggled, you know, eight balls for the entire hour. It wouldn't have made a shit's bit of difference. The show was getting canceled anyway when they did the revamp of the TV around the time September of 1986, when Superstars debuts on September 6th. TNT lasts a couple weeks after that, but it was all over after it was 99 or 100 episodes. I forget which one it was. But to go back to May of 1985... coming off the heels of WrestleMania, which is March 31st at Madison Square Garden. Just beyond this all-enhancement talent TNT, or the unsung heroes, very interesting month for the WWF. A lot of things going on, such as on May 11th, you get the first Saturday Night's Main Event that airs, and that could be an interesting show for me to cover at some point in the future. I did cover the one from October of 85 with Uncle Elmer's wedding. Do check that out in the archives. So that starts a fruitful relationship, well, mostly fruitful, at least for the WWF, that lasts until 1991 before NBC just decides that they have better things to put on TV on Saturday nights about five or six times a year. Later in the month, on the 24th at the UIC Pavilion in Chicago, a rather interesting show that aired 3 days later, the WWF on AM Chicago, which was a local talk show there. And WWF is still pretty new to Chicago. That was AWA territory. So this is kind of them sliding in. They get the momentum with WrestleMania. The AWA was still doing good up to a certain point in 1984. I think losing Bobby Heenan was much more of a death blow than losing Hulk Hogan was earlier in the year, despite me doing a January of 84 AWA show and just hating it. But that show is interesting, the AM Chicago, because Oprah Winfrey is involved, and this is before her show went national, syndicated, oddly enough, around the same time as the WWF TV revamp in September of 1986. I can remember seeing the billboards for Oprah and her coming talk show when I went to Disney World the first time in 86. I don't know why that stuck with me for so long. She actually does the commentary on the three matches that they show alongside Gentleman Jerry Valiant. I mean, you want to talk about strange announced teams in WWF history? Oprah Winfrey and Jerry Valiant, it's got to be a clear number one. I mean, make Josh Matthews and Santino Marella look perfectly normal. Of course, heard from them on last week's show. The main event in the program was Hulk Hogan against the Magnificent Morocco. Earlier that month, now, this probably only means something to me and for those of you who really care about the televised house shows in the Northeast. The first Boston Garden show on the New England Sports Network on May 18th at the Boston Garden. It was Gene Okerlund and Gorilla Monsoon on the call. And you might wonder, why weren't the shows taped before that point? Because Philly had been on Prism since 1979. And Madison Square Garden shows had been on HBO and the MSG network for an even longer time, dating back to almost the early 70s. I think 1973 is one of the earliest ones that I saw. That's because the New England Sports Network was not founded until 1984, basically a partnership between the Boston Red Sox and the Boston Bruins for their home games for the Boston Bruins. For the Red Sox, they put on probably about half their games, some of them home, some of them road. They still would televise a few home games on free TV, particularly on Fridays. But it was a pay channel in the Boston area for about the first decade and a half that it was available on cable systems. In 1985 was the year it started to become a little bit more widely available. And the last thing from May of 1985, they debuted in Milwaukee, which is kind of like a cousin of them trying to break into Chicago. And that was on May 31st, that debut up there in Wisconsin's largest city. It was 13 years to the day before the Over the Edge 1998 pay-per-view. And yes, I realize that is something that may only interest me. But Tuesday Night Titans, TNT, whatever you want to call it, it's always something I enjoy having on in the background. If I'm doing something else, if I'm paying bills, if I'm, you know, buying songs off Amazon, wink, or whatever, really. They're not going to show matches like, oh, I have to be glued to this one. And none of the interviews are particularly compelling unless somebody goes particularly crazy, which does happen on this show. So if you throw this one on, attention should be paid to certain parts of it. And think of this show as me guiding you through all of that. So without any further ado, why don't I just get right to it? WWF TNT for May 3rd, 1985.
Combine the power of gymnastics with the force of karate, and an all-new martial art is born. Gymkata. Kurt Thomas, three-time world gymnastics champion, takes on a secret mission for the United States government. His only weapon, Gymkata. And that's all he needs. Gymkata.
Starts Friday at a theater near you. Check local listings.
Now, for those of you who are not familiar with the film Gymkata, which came out May 3rd, 1985, I should read what exactly the plot element was of this movie so you will truly understand how ridiculous the premise of this thing was, starring Kurt Thomas. Here it is. Jonathan Cabot, Thomas, is approached by the Special Intelligence Agency. I always love when they make up, like, the fake names, like, when they got Justin Timberlake on that show that Ashton Kutcher punked, or whatever the hell it was called. I don't really care. Like, when they would make up, like, the fake IRS name. But anyway, Special Intelligence Agency to play the game.
Time to play the game!
Whoa. Why is this interrupting me? Just because I said the game? And it's a big part of the movie Gymkhana? Anyway, the game is an athletic competition in the fictional country of Parmistan. Sounds like something from an Italian restaurant. A tiny mountain nation which is supposedly located in the Hindu Kush mountain range. Parmistan forces all foreigners to play the game, which is basically an endurance race with obstacles, all the while being chased by local Parmistan warriors. I'm sorry, I can't read this anymore. It actually still mildly hurts to laugh based on my incision thick. Yes, Gymkhana, that's entirely where Triple H ended up getting his gimmick nickname from. So, as I had mentioned, this is the Classics On Demand version. So at the beginning of the video, they tell us how on Oh My God May, OMG May is coming up or something, where they're going to show those type of crazy moments. You know, basically all the Mick Foley stuff over the years, him getting thrown off a cage, him getting speared by Edge through a flaming table, you know, all that sort of stuff. And I talked about the dubbed theme. The original theme was 1980 by Herb Alpert, a wonderful artist. I just downloaded Route 101, good song that you hear on the Yacht Rock channel. That's of course what it's called. Sorry, I'm a little distracted by the Billy Joel channel having made its triumphant return last week. But when you watch TNT's on the network with the dubbing, the hilarious thing is it sounds like Lord Alfred Hayes has to shout over the dub, like almost like they planned for it in some way, or he's like, you could barely hear him. But this show, the sponsorship is left in. They usually cut a lot of this stuff, like the Mountain Dew Slam of the Night on Saturday night's main event, but this is sponsored by Castrol for when you're on the gas, which is very appropriate for 1985 WWF. So what we get is an elite selection of the WWF's unsung heroes. That's what they're pushing on us today, and I am more than happy to accept this. So think of these guys as the super jobbers of the World Wrestling Federation. They're almost all familiar names that you would see on television. I mean, if you watched wrestling in the mid to late 80s, you're going to know all nine of these names in all likelihood. So Lord Alfred Hayes, other than being the announcer, he is also the sidekick, the Ed McMahon, to Vince McMahon's Johnny Carson. Kind of interesting that the name McMahon shows up in both places. Just as Lord Al was the sidekick on the Bobby Heenan show in 1989, for it was only there for 4 weeks, and I should just cover one of those Heenan shows. So they're talking, Vince and Lord Al, about what it means to be one of these unsung heroes and how they're fighting, they're scrapping, they're clawing, they're trying to make their way in the world of professional wrestling.
Lord Alfred Hayes, climbing the ladder of success is not easy in the World Wrestling Federation.
I think it's the hardest thing that any professional sportsman can accomplish in a world of sport such as wrestling, of course, I'm referring to. When I first started wrestling, I had 10 matches signed contract-wise. If I hadn't have had that contract, I would never have completed them. I would have dropped out after the first one.
I can certainly appreciate Lord Al stressing the importance of setting goals for yourself, you know, those 10 matches, but that's the hardest thing to do in professional sports or whatever the hell it was that he said. I mean, I would say hitting a baseball is probably harder, especially, you know, breaking pitches and such. Hitting 400 like Ted Williams did, even though it was an era where there was not really much in relief pitchers or whatever, but and they weren't really shifting him yet at that point. But I mean, that's very, very difficult. It's much more difficult. Playing quarterback in the NFL, even though that's gotten easier, I think, over the years as kids grow up playing Madden. Anyway, I'm going way off track here. It's important to set goals. That's what I got out of that. So they toss it now to a match between David Sammartino and Bob Wade. Now, this is from the March 23rd edition of Championship Wrestling. Yes, I actually looked up when all of this stuff aired on other shows. Now, you're saying, well, who is the jobber in this one? Like, okay, no, they're still taking David Sammartino seriously at this point. So Bob Wade is such a pure jobber in the parlance of Kelly from the WorldCast podcast. There's no cage match link for this guy. I don't recognize the name. He did have other matches if you seek him out on YouTube, but Bob Wade, not exactly a guy that you associate with mid-1980s WWF television, if you catch my drift. So as they show, he's basically the cautionary tale of, this is the guy that's so pathetic that we're not even going to have him on the show. We're going to have 9 different guys who are definitely above him. And I am shocked, absolutely shocked, that David Sammartino, at the start of this clip, starts out with a friggin' backdrop driver. I swear on a stack of Bibles that that is what happened.
David, going right behind Wade quickly, grabbed it. Oh, look. Oh, my goodness. Forget about it. Whoa, my goodness. Talk about a suplex. Wade will be feeling that one for the next 567 years.
Even Vince is so stunned he pulls 567 years out of his ass because he has absolutely no idea what to call it. But David, he's just letting All Japan know that, yeah, I was there in the spring of 84 for a tour, and I'm ready to come back at some point, which I guess won't be until 1988, but... Hey, the last name, Sammartino, I guess will, you know, give you a little bit more slack. I mean, say this for him. He's not good, but he's not Angelo Mosca Jr. bad. Not by any means. He's not a complete, you know, complete zero in the ring. So Wade, if they follow it up, he gets press slammed. And when he gets tossed down, he almost lands on his freaking head. So, I mean, that could have been disastrous as well. And David finishes the match with the Ted DiBiase Power Slam. Apparently, he's just trying to appeal to me here. I give the Ted Power Slam 5.5 out of 10, which is probably where David Sammartino is probably going to max out on it. So, like I said, Bob Wade is their cautionary tale because he almost gets injured legitimately a couple of times on this, as Lord Hal goes into.
I think there were 3 definite parts there. Firstly, this young man stepped into the ring with a Sammartino and he was in awe. All wrestling knowledge seemed to leave his mind. He was in awe of a Sammartino. Secondly, he suffered from that devastating suplex, and I think he was virtually out of it from there on in, because by the time he was thrown into that turnbuckle and he came out, Sammartino pressed him and then threw him. He came over, he didn't have the ability to tuck his chin into his chest, which all wrestlers do, and protect his head. He landed right on the back of his head. After that, it was finished for him. But I must compliment his courage.
To translate that, Lord Al's like, stupid dumbass didn't know how to tuck his chin, which is what all wrestlers are supposed to do in order to protect himself. And yes, everybody does that. It's one of the things, you know, how you're supposed to work a match. I don't know what James Ellsworth does, because I haven't seen him around for a while since that whole thing, which apparently nothing became of it, because the 16-year-old girl was of age in whatever state it happened to be in. So I'm not defending the guy. It's still a little bit creepy, but my God. So we're going to play up the courage angle with these fellas, which, to my mind, is a good way to do it, because, you know, you're not going to talk about any glory they might have had. There's that word. It's going to come up again and again as they show a replay of the backdrop driver press slam, and they actually point out where Bob Wade does not tuck his chin in. So, coming up, you know, so we get to reveal some of the names on this show, Johnny Rods and Rusty Brooks and Pete Doherty, as they go in to the commercial break.
Hi, we're New Edition. We're here to introduce the great new taste of Coca-Cola, the taste of today.
Yeah, Coke is it.
Come on, check it out now. It's got a new taste. It's a definite
wow.
A brain event.
It's here. A big smash hit.
Coke is it.
The show aired May of 85. It was about 2 weeks into the run of New Coke, which would thankfully be abbreviated. I'm going to disavow you of the notion that, oh, they did this on purpose as a publicity stunt. Oh, no, no. They really thought that changing the formula to make it more like Pepsi was going to kind of help build the brand back up a little bit. And as it turns out, people ended up missing it. I will, however, entertain the conspiracy theory that they did do this and then switch back so that they could go to high fructose corn syrup, because you can only get the cane sugar in, and nothing to do with the Big Red Machine, but Coca-Cola, I guess, is a Big Red Machine. Anyway, you can get real sugar in Mexican Coke, which you can find at a lot of grocery stores these days. At BJ's Wholesale, you can pick up a 24-pack of it for about $21. But anyway, so Vince McMahon, he's looking quite dapper in his three-piece suit that looks peach on the video that I have. But when you watch it on the WWE Network, it looks like a completely different color. Now, this is what happens when you watch videos from the mid-80s. Now, his guess at this time, even though he doesn't say that, making everybody today who was an interviewer say that exact phrase, Mario Mancini, Steve Lombardi, and Paul Roma, which is like the greatest Sons of Italy six-man. I mean, you'd throw them at any independent show held at a Sons of Italy hall, and these three guys are the most over babyface, I think. Now, I'm going to do this for all the trios that come out. And by the way, it'd be a pretty good Chikara King of Trios with the three groups we got going on out here. And I'd give these guys, I don't know if they're the favorites, but with Paul Roma there, given the career that he had. Now, Mario Mancini is definitely the best dressed out of all of them. Speaking of Coke, he looks like he's ready to do some Coke off a dancer at Studio 54. I'm definitely not laughing at Mario Mancini, but his collar has such a wide wingspan, I thought it was a DC-10 for a second. In any event, he, like I said, he's ready to go clubbing, but I'd look into Mario Mancini more, and I don't know how many matches of his that I've covered on the show, but here we are, May of 1985, and I'm looking at him like, okay, this guy's been around the block. He's probably about 30, 31 years old, just, you know, for the kind of grizzled look that he has. So I look up his bio. Mario Mancini was born June 21st, 1966. Holy crap. He's 18 years old. If you look at this guy, he's the oldest looking 18-year-old this side of Greg Oden, the college basketball player from the last decade who you've already forgotten about. So Mancini actually gets the good seat. Another reason why I thought he was older is he is able to take the seat next to Vince, because I've watched enough late night talk shows to know that if you got two guests, the one that's closer to the host has the advantage. And you don't want to be the guy that's further away. And they probably organized it in a certain way. But, you know, I like I said, I've seen enough of these things to know how it really goes. So yeah, Mario Mancini started wrestling at the age of 18. So he embarks upon this grand career, just like Alex Rodriguez and Robin Yount in baseball. So it goes for Mario Mancini. He's 18 years old. I'm sorry, I'm never going to be able to get past this. He did pick up a singles win in late 84 against Gino Carabello. Now, how does it feel to be Gino Carabello when you're losing to Mario Mancini? It was on a house show, of course. I would love to see a handheld of that. That would be fantastic. But I don't think any handhelds of any Mario Mancini house show matches exist. But now that I know what his age is, and it appears to be legitimate, this is not a Cuban baseball player thing, tell us about your history, Mario.
I started wrestling at a very young age. I started a month after I graduated from high school. I'm 18 now. I'll turn 19 in 2 months. And it's a very tough road with the much more experienced wrestlers than I'm facing now.
This Mario Mancini is 18 years old thing blows my mind in the same way as finding out that Earthquake was 26 years old when he debuted in the WWF at the end of 1989, when he squashes Hulk Hogan on the Brother Love Show. He's 26 years old. You say, okay, if Mario Mancini ever shared a ring with Earthquake, and indeed they did. It was not in the natural disasters Earthquake was by that point. December 1st, 1991, Wrestling Challenge. Maybe I'll get to that at some point. I mean, hell, it's a 1991 show, so I probably will. Now, Paul Roma, very youthful looking himself. He had just turned 25, and he debuted at the very end of 1984 in a team with Sal Bellomo. You're talking about an Italian super team against Adrian Adonis and Dick Murdoch in a match on All-American Wrestling. So quite a way to make your debut. And Roma and Mancini are linked because Roma is a trainer at Paradise Alley Pro Wrestling. And the owner of Paradise Alley Pro Wrestling is Mario Mancini. That's based down in Southern Connecticut. So, Roma, they ask him. Once again, we're going back to Bob Wade and him getting dumped on his head. So, Paul Roma, let's get his thoughts on the experience of that poor bastard.
Well, basically, that's, you know, if you can't shake it off, you lose it. And it's very hard to come back after being suplexed. You lose your sight, your balance, and an experienced wrestler will take advantage of that and pin you.
A lot of people talk about Paul Roma's height and how in the 1980s that's something that held him back. But the fact that he wasn't a really good talker, that's also going to hold him back, especially if he's there as a babyface. Now, he finally found himself when he got to be a heel, but it was within a tag team. And then he also had Slick as his talker. So, I don't know, we never really got to find out if he was any good at it. But I'm going to say that I probably doubt it, although He's been okay in interviews that I've heard, at least, you know, in the podcast circuit the last several years. Now, for a second, as we get to Steve Lombardi, I thought that Vince had called him Steven, like he was scolding him or like being ultra serious, but apparently Vince was saying Steve, and we talked about it, Steve and, not Steven, but, you know, I like the idea of Vince scolding Steve Lombardi. Well, of course, every time with Lombardi, it's always going to be something. You got to read something into what he's saying here.
Well, it's not easy. If it was easy, anyone could do it. You just got to keep coming back. If you love the sport, if you love it with all your heart, you're just going to keep coming back.
Well, from everything that I've ever heard, coming back was Steve Lombardi's specialty at the Terry Garvin School of Self-Defense. Anyway, we got to showcase all these guys who are on the show, which means 9 matches are going to be shown on this program. Not necessarily in their entirety, but they do tend to be quicker squashes. Not to mention David Sammartino and Bob Wade, so that's actually 10 matches. I think that might be a new record for this show. So we start out with Steve Lombardi, who's in there with Short Trunks Ricky Steamboat, which is how you know that it's very, very early in his run. And it's a test of strength as they go to the videotape of that from the March 16th episode of Championship Wrestling, which Steamboat just kind of steps out of the test of strength and lands a dropkick. And Lombardi gets extremely flustered, he, you know, kind of walking around, doesn't quite know what to do. And he locks up, they lock up again. And Lombardi actually rakes the face and hits a back elbow and sends Steamboat's head into the turnbuckle. And then actually makes the mistake of tossing Ricky Steamboat over the top rope, which it's a mistake because, you know, he's just going to skin the cat back in. Apparently, Lombardi has been so caught up trying to make a name for himself in the WWF since 83 that he didn't bother to watch any Mid-Atlantic tapes and know that Ricky Steamboat was going to come back in and do that. And when he does, he hits a couple drop kicks, an Irish whip, a shoulder block. And then he goes up top for the flying body press for the win. So Lombardi got a little bit of shine here, but he also kind of looked bad in parts, and I never really much cared for Steve Lombardi's offense. So we get an immediate cut to another newcomer, King Kong Bundy, in there against Mario Mancini. This is also from the March 16th Championship Wrestling. It's actually the first Bundy match on that show, but it was not his debut on WWF TV. He apparently was rolled out for the March 9th Georgia Championship Wrestling show down at Techwood Studio. So kind of an odd little footnote. Now, I complain about Lombardi's offense, and Mancini never really had much of an arsenal to speak of himself because this was not a guy who was going to get a minute of shine and then have the star roll out of the ring and get his act together. That was not really his thing. He was just there to take an ass whooping. So Bundy is doing the usual big man sort of stuff, very punchy, not so much kicky, but more like forearm clubbering, I guess, as Dusty Rhodes would say. Vince helpfully lets us know that Mario Mancini is not related to boxer Ray Boom Boom Mancini, who was a star of note in the early 80s. Unfortunately, for being a guy who, an opponent, Duck Koo Kim, back in 82 or 83, died shortly after a bout with Mancini, which led to all the boxing organizations making it 12 rounds rather than 15, because that round, that match went to the 14th round. His career was, his boxing career was on a hiatus after two losses. You can understand if his opponent dies, he kind of went into a mental funk after that point. Avalanche in the corner, and Bundy picks up the three count. He's not yet asking for the five count. That would not come until later, because that would screw up the WrestleMania fast win if you have to count the five instead of three, because then the damn SD Jones thing would have lasted 25 seconds instead of 23 seconds, and then people definitely would have noticed that it was not 9 seconds. Now, for our final one, we get Paul Roma in there against Brutus Beefcake. This one's a little earlier from the March 2nd Championship Wrestling. And as I said, Roma is even less experienced than either of the other two guys. However, he's got a solid sock game where he's got the striped socks hanging up over his boot, a la Butch Reed. I'm always kind of fond of that. It feels like a real 80s thing. Anybody still doing that in 1990, I don't approve. But you know, for as long as 8 is the third number in the year, I'm all right with it. Beefcake's offense is not very good either. Apparently, this is the thing I'm going to complain about with everybody. I mean, who does a rest hold in a friggin' squash match? Apparently, 1985 Brutus Beefcake does. And Roma gets a couple of arm drags, and his face gets raked because Beefcake did not yet respect people's faces at that point. Off an Irish whip, Beefcake put his head down, a cardinal mistake for a ring veteran, but Roma did a leapfrog over him, and as he bounded off the ropes on the other side, Beefcake hit him with the high knee, which was not yet a booty man pun at that time, and that is how he picked up the three count. So Roma, where he gets a little bit of shine as well, but it gets cut off very, very suddenly, and he makes one mistake, and he ends up eating the pinfall. So it is kind of the theme of what we see with these guys, where you have, like, not necessarily their SD Jones Memorial Charge moment, for which I've so named, longtime listeners to the program know that when you watch SD Jones matches, he always has a charge to the corner where he just eats turnbuckle or just misses or runs into a boot, and that is why it is named for him. So Roma, you know, having watched that, I think he may, maybe he's starting to grasp where he's going wrong.
Yeah, just about. He knocked me out for, well, a little while, and when I came to, the match was over.
All right, but here you have a gentleman like yourself. You haven't had a great deal of experience, but Brutus Beefcake certainly has. I mean, right, to be able to stay in there as long as you did with Brutus Beefcake, does that give you confidence, or does the fact that you lost the match, does it destroy you in terms of your confidence?
Well, no, it doesn't destroy me. Wrestling somebody with his ability and staying in that long, as you said, builds my confidence, because I'm a young wrestler, I'm coming up, and well, if the fans stay behind me and stay with me, it's not so bad.
Well, you know what they say, Roma, it's a long road to glory, and for him it would be about 5+ years. So Mario Mancini, the angle Vince takes with him is like, you're in there with Bundy, who's this huge dude. Do you have any idea what the hell you're getting into?
Well, I realized that he was more than 3 times the size of me, obviously. To be honest with you, Vince, I never ever felt a feeling like I felt getting hit like a brick wall. But I found that I practically got knocked out. But I find that whoever I'm going against or whoever I'm going to wrestle, no matter how much punishment, I'd have nose broken, you know, my nose getting broken, and skin torn off the side of my face from the getting scraped on the mat. But I have an attitude, and my attitude is I'm young, and no matter how much punishment I'm going to take, I'm going to come back, and I'm going to be there. I'll always be there.
I'm sorry, I just can't get past the fact that Mario Mancini is 18 years old when this airs. I mean, the drinking age in Connecticut, where he lived at that time, was 20. It was soon to be 21, But you think, okay, so let's say he wrestles a squash match, let's say against Adonis and Murdoch. It's like Dick Murdoch takes a shine to this youngster. Like, hey, kid, want to come out for a beer with me? Like, well, you know, he can't do that because he's not of drinking age. Mario Mancini, a man who I am watching on Tuesday Night Titans in 1985, but yet he is only 13 years older than I am. How is this even possible? He's high school class of 1984. Hey, I probably should get off that for now. But Steve Lombardi, maybe known for being a little bit too overconfident in the ring, and he believes that that might have been his issue in there with Ricky Steamboat.
Did you not? That you had the upper hand and became a little overconfident?
You could say that in a way, but I'm getting the impression now at the stage I'm in that nice guys finish last. You got to get out there and do what you can. Whatever it takes to win, you got to get out there and do it.
Seems to be a completely different attitude than what we have here with Paul and Mario. A little more of an arrogant attitude, really.
That's the way I feel. That's the way I feel. I feel at this point in my career, I need some guidance. Perhaps Bobby the Brain Heenan, who produces nothing but winners. And that's what I want to be, is a winner. So that's the attitude I have to take.
Lombardi's kind of staking out his own territory, kind of like when you have like those primary debates with Democrats or Republicans where one person will move far to the left or somebody will try to outflank somebody to the right, something along those lines. Lombardi is trying to cement himself as the heel jobber, which he would hold on to like grim death for years to come. And Bobby Heenan as his manager, get the hell out of here. Like that would happen in a million years or perhaps four. So Lord Alfred Hayes is just sitting there on the end hanging out, and Vince is amused by Lord Al's voice, just like we all are. And what do you think, Lord Al, the prospects for these young men?
Well, I would say that all three of them have that personal desire to get to the very top of the ladder, which is an excellent thing. But I would like to, we're not going to have the time, but I'd like to look more closely at what gives them that drive. Is it for money? Is it for glory? Is it for something they want to personally achieve? What are these things that drive them there? We're not going to have the time, but there is one thing all three of them have in common, and that is the thing we discussed before, courage.
Well, it would take a few years, but we'd eventually figure out that one of them was in it for glory. And they actually do pick up on these talking points in the next couple of segments where, you know, to try to get inside the head of these guys, where Lord Al was trying to go with it, like, oh, we're not going to have enough time because they have reached the end of Act One. So that's it for Mancini, Lombardi, and Roma. So bring on the next three ham and eggers, as Bobby Heenan would say. I know the network has done away with hidden gems, so I guess it just kind of is wherever you find them, and they might even be hiding in plain sight, and who's going to watch, you know, a TNT from the middle of its run with a series of guests who were mostly enhancement talents, but this truly would be a hidden gem, I think, as we get Act 2, which is Jim Powers, future Young Stallion, Jose Luis Rivera, and Rusty Brooks, the man who would absolutely make this segment in so many different ways. Now, to analyze all three of them as they come out, Brooks looks like he just left the Elks Club, and I don't mean he was attending a chaotic wrestling show out in Hudson. I'm saying that he's a member there and just had a few belts and is on his way home to his wife that he might be a little fatigued of at this point, and his kids who he just feels are very, very annoying. So I don't know. There's a whole backstory that I'm still sketching out for him. Jim Powers, he looks like he's got to go out on a second date with a girl that he met at the gym. You know, he doesn't look too nice, like not as nice as you would look like on a first date, and it's not the third date, so he's not trying to close the sale. It's something in between. And Jose Luis Rivera, he looks like he's going clubbing with Mancini later. Now, Rusty Brooks, being the biggest guy here, clearly, in the neighborhood of 340, 345, he's going to get the close seat to Vince. And because of his rather large carriage, and while he might not be a muscle guy, he certainly gets Vince McMahon's attention.
A big, big man. Rusty Brooks, how much do you weigh?
342 pounds.
342 pounds. That is a big boy. Very big. And Jose, you're up around what?
About 240.
About 240?
I swear to God, Rusty Brooks made that noise of... Like, oh, because Jose Luis Rivera is only 240 pounds and Rusty Brooks is 342 pounds. He's just scoffing at everything left and right. And yes, let the Rusty Brooks show begin. Jim Powers is at 235. I mean, he's mostly working on the arms. But before we go any further with the great Rusty Brooks, I'm certainly never going to do an IWCCW show. They did a lot of weird stuff over the years, which actually, now that I think about it, I probably should do some. I should probably do a show that has Vic Steamboat versus Tony Atlas. Oh, wait, that's pretty much all of them. Except Rusty Brooks, after leaving the WWF, he made his way down to, you know, other promotions. He worked a lot in Florida. I think Future of Wrestling, FOW, was a promotion that he wrestled in. But his IWCCW stint is memorable for the character that he portrayed. Now, you've heard of Super Mario Brothers and Mario. Of course, Captain Lou Albano portrayed him on television. But Rusty Brooks, he's just a little bit better than that because he portrayed a character, Super Duper Mario.
Hello, everybody out there in the television land. This is Super Duper Mario. I got a few of the little messages for my bambinos. We should all know that the school is going to be getting out soon, and we want you all to be careful so you have a safe and a pleasant summer vacation. I also got a message for my mama. She wanted me to say hello to Baba Dow, and she also wanted me to say to the Boston Cream Puff.
Obviously, that came much later because the Nintendo Entertainment System and Mario Brothers had only come out in the United States around this point. IWCCW, this is several years down the road. Crazy character to play. Oh, the kids are flocking to him in that Bugsy McGraw 1982 world class sort of way. Although, with him being that character, it's not quite as creepy because he's clearly the guy from the video games. But why don't we put that aside and go back to 1985, where Rusty Brooks, an absolute tour de force on this program. Now, it's easy when you're out there with Jim Powers, who's a little bit shy and reserved, and Jose Luis Rivera, who clearly English, probably not his first language. So Rusty knows that this is a golden opportunity for him. For him to get some shine that, yeah, he might get his ass kicked in 2 minutes on Championship Wrestling every other week, but this is a chance to tell us about the inner Rusty.
Right. I used to play football as a lineman at North Texas State.
You played...
So we worked upper body.
Right.
In that state. North Texas State in Denton.
Pretty tough league down there.
Well, anywhere in Texas, they grow them big and they play good ball. They wrestle well. Big, tough guys down that way.
So you had an amateur experience in terms of wrestling in addition to football?
Yeah, a little wrestling too, mostly football.
Mm-hmm.
From there, I went on to professional wrestling, which I've been doing approximately 4 years now.
And where do you think you are in terms of where you want to be?
Well, I feel like I'm about this much away from getting up to where I want to be. I don't like to be considered in the same class as these two gentlemen here who obviously have a long way to go.
I love the Rusty Brooks game plan coming into this, treating it like a Comedy Central roast where he's just going to bury all the other guys up there. I mean, there's going to be no holding back. How many chances is this guy going to have to talk on WWF programming? this might be the first time he's ever had that opportunity. Now, if you think a jab like that is as far as he's going to go, oh, no, 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 no. Rusty Brooks, he is far from done. All I'm waiting for is for him to pull Gilbert Gottfried and just start going into doing his version of the Aristocrats.
See, I feel like if you people, these people in this WWE would put me in with anyone of these two gentlemen, my record would improve incredibly.
It would.
Well, I believe so. The first time I come up here, I get stuck in the ring with this 7'4" geek you call a giant. Why don't you put me in with him?
Well, perhaps that's a good point. What about, you seem to be making it relatively well on your own, but earlier on, one of our guests had mentioned that perhaps Lombardi, as a matter of fact, had mentioned that he was looking for someone to handle his career, much like a Bobby the Brain Heenan. Would that assist you, you feel? Or?
Oh, I feel immeasurably. Bobby Heenan's record speaks for itself. I think I could improve his record quite more.
I mean, listen to the confidence in Rusty Brooks. The difference between him and Lombardi is Lombardi seemed to be, well, I could get over the hump if I could just get Bobby Heenan as my manager. Whereas Rusty Brooks takes the approach of, well, you know, I would definitely improve Bobby Heenan's standing. Like Heenan would need to be lifted up by Rusty Brooks. Oh my God, it is so amazing. He's basically like booking his own angle on this. It's so incredible.
So you feel that you're just waiting for a break, an opportunity, or someone that's...
Oh, yes. Oh, definitely. With the proper management, I think I could go all the way to the top.
All right, Rusty.
No problem.
Rusty Brooks is absolutely the GOAT because he swallowed up all the time before they actually go into the matches. Like, Powers doesn't get a chance to talk. Jose Luis Rivera, he doesn't get a chance to talk before we go into the first bout, which is Jim Powers against the Intercontinental Champion Greg the Hammer Valentine from the February 9th edition of Championship Wrestling. And I talked several episodes ago that Jim Powers might have been well served to go somewhere else for a while instead of just constantly losing in the WWF for years, except for that Young Stallions interlude in 87 and 88 where they won just a little bit. Apparently, Jim Powers turned up in World Class at various points in late 1985. Maybe he could have gone there and become like a fake Von Erich or something for a little while. I mean, he had the hair and all. He had the physique for it. Maybe he could have been like Dennis Von Erich or something like that. I don't know. I mean, they kind of start to run out of names at this point. And anyway, Powers is just not following up on a kick to the head as we go to the match, and Valentine's just kind of staggering around the ring. And Bruno actually points this out on commentary, because this is 85 Bruno, where he's actually still talking on a regular basis. So Valentine shakes it off, beats Powers' ass, and starts working the leg, hits that great Greg Valentine vertical suplex where he kind of throws him with one arm, and the figure four finishes. So the story of Jim Powers is a lack of killer instinct, and he allowed a man time to recover, and then all of a sudden, he's looking up at the lights, giving up to the figure four leg lock. Now we go to the great Rusty Brooks in there with the Junkyard Dog, who did not look like him at first because he was wearing all black tights with a little bit of red trim, I think it was. This is from the January 19th edition of Championship Wrestling. Now, Rusty is in his traditional green and white singlet-looking thing with the long tights on the bottom. Kind of like a Minnesota North Stars look in terms of the color scheme that he's going. JYD scores with a bell ringer, not to be confused... Bell ringer? Oh, boy, there's the accent right there. That's not to be confused with a Zev bell ringer. If you actually do a Google search for Zev bell ringer, that's a completely different thing, I can assure you, from your point of view. An Irish whip, big clothesline, but Rusty Brooks kicks out at two. Like, very interesting. So JYD locks in a chin lock. Once again, another rest hold in a squash match. But, hey, you got two big boys in there, okay? I'm going to excuse this. It's just for Rusty's sake. And Rusty gets an Irish whip, and he goes for a friggin' drop kick. Now, that is some confidence, but he ends up missing it entirely. And JYD finishes the match off with a shoulder block, because you can't really do the thump power slam. Oh, JYD probably could have gotten him up, but That's, if you ever wonder why there aren't a lot of jobbers who weigh close to 350 pounds, part of it is you can't do the finishing moves. Some of the guys, they just can't. Like, can you imagine Coco Beware trying to get Rusty Brooks up for the Ghostbuster? That shit's just not going to happen. I'm sorry. Now, we got another interesting match. And it's interesting not for Jose Luis Rivera, who we've all watched a million times, but on the other side is Jim the Anvil Neidhart, pre-Hart Foundation, with Mr. Fuji at ringside. And this actually was the first television match for the Anvil in the WWF. He had a Beal out of the corner, and he actually pulls Rivera up on a pinfall attempt. Now, Rivera does score with a drop kick, so we get a little bit of a fiery comeback, but Jose, he knows, he hung out with SD Jones on more than one occasion. He runs into a foot in the corner, the SD Jones Memorial Charge, and the Jim Neidhart Power Slam finishes because, well, you know, Jay White didn't get to do his, but Anvil can because Jose Luis Rivera, as we found out, weighs 100 pounds less than Rusty Brooks. Scoffing at it. You know, hey, Rusty was right. I mean, he didn't have to take the Power Slam. He forced his opponent to find another way to beat him. Now, as we go back to the TNT studio, Rusty has his arms crossed like he just does not give a shit what's going on here. He is totally out for himself. In psychology, they teach, you know, when you have your arms crossed like that, it basically means you're closing yourself off. I prefer to think of Rusty as kind of being like the great Burt Reynolds character from SNL Celebrity Jeopardy, where he just kind of his arms folded during final.
Ah, Burt Reynolds.
Who is Scooby-Doo?
No.
Yeah. That was a funny dog, Scooby-Doo. He drove around a van and solved mysteries.
That is incorrect.
No, that's correct. I remember, he had a pal, Scrappy-Doo.
I don't care what anyone says. Burt Reynolds is the best character in this Celebrity Jeopardy skits just because of the way Norm would portray him. Daryl Hammond is a little too dark for my taste. Not just with the Sean Connery thing, but just how Daryl Hammond is. He's too Daryl Hammond-y. It's like his Bill Clinton. He's trying too hard to be what Bill Clinton actually sounds like. It's like, I prefer the Phil Hartman one where he's like a cartoonish version of Bill Clinton. Like, that's funnier to me. That's just my opinion. So, as we go back, Jose Luis Rivera, he's going to get a chance to talk about his match and maybe some of the opportunities that he might have missed. I mean, after all, you know, he's in there with Jim the Anvil Neidhart. But this is the Rusty Brooks show, okay? And he's going to do whatever the hell he wants. Hell, he's even going to make a play to be the floor director.
It's a tough one, yes. Tough contender. When he threw me down with that suplex that he gave me.
Speak up a little, man.
You take it easy, okay? You do your speed, let me do mine. So you stay there, come off a little bit, and that's catch you out for a little while, so you have to recuperate again sometime.
Mm-hmm. Now, Rivera is an American citizen because he was born in Puerto Rico, but he probably grew up speaking Spanish in the house, and English is his second language. So, I don't know, maybe Rusty's a little bit hard on him because, and with English being his second language, I'm just here to remind you right now, I mean, we here in America, we take it for granted speaking English or whatever form of English people from Boston speak in my case, but English is a real pain in the ass language, and never forget that. Probably said it before on the podcast, but English is objectively weird as a language relative to other ones, particularly the Romance languages. But anyway, so Jose Luis Rivera, he's going to get a chance to talk about who he considers his role model coming up in wrestling. But once again, the great Rusty Brooks, he's over there in the first chair just booking his own angles.
We got Pedro Morales, one of them.
You find that humorous, Rusty?
Well, you got a has-been and a never was.
A has-been Pedro Morales, and it never was?
Well, how many years has it been since you've seen Pedro Morales?
Well,
good Lord.
The man was a world heavyweight champ.
How many years ago?
Yes, but he's still on action right now. You would see him
well, you can call
soon.
It that. I don't.
Well, that's your opinion. Different, somebody partner, got a different opinion on.
I tell you, partner, we see things different, that's all.
So no matter what your feelings are about Pedro Morales, who was the WWF champion before this, but it had been a long time, as Rusty points out. It was the end of 73 when he lost that title. So we're talking over 11 years since that occurred. He was the Intercontinental champion in the early 80s on a couple of occasions. So, you know, maybe Rusty wasn't paying too much attention there. And perhaps he just does not get it, Pedro Morales' appeals to the Latino population, which is in part why he had become champion. Vince Sr. kind of, you know, was banking on the ethnic champion to draw crowds to MSG, because he had done so with Bruno, and Pedro comes in, and he does good in New York, but not as well in the other cities, so that leads to Bruno coming back later, because Bruno was a much better drawer in places like Philly and Boston. Now, if you wonder, where is Pedro Morales at this point anyway? He actually had been gone since the April 1983 MSG show. That's his last WWF show on record, so for over 2 years, but there was already a match in the can when this TNT had aired. Now, I don't know when this show was actually taped, of course, but he would appear in a six-man match teaming with Junkyard Dog and Tito Santana on the March 11th edition of Championship Wrestling. So his return is only 8 days away from airing. Now, I want you to keep in mind that there are three guys out here, and I don't think Jim Powers has talked yet. For all the Rusty Brooks stuff that has happened so far, Jim Powers is sitting two seats down from him, and I don't think has said a freaking peep. Now, with Roma, I talked about the Young Stallions and how, well, you didn't really hear them talk on a regular basis. And I got to be honest, coming into this, I have no idea what Jim Powers' voice sounds like. I just don't remember.
The way I look at it is every time I get in the ring with somebody like that or of that caliber, I learn. Mm-hmm. And I'm still a learning stage. I'm sure my time will come.
Well, a victory, I would think, what do you think about before a match like that? I mean, to me, that would be a great opportunity in your shoes. I mean, here's Valentine, as you said, as a champion, and it's not a title match, but a victory over him would really, in a non-title match even, would really catapult your career, wouldn't it?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. And I'm nervous. You're definitely nervous before a match like that. But you do the best you can.
I have to give Powers credit on two fronts. Number one, his sunny disposition going forward, like, I'm going to get better. And that's a good way, I think, to approach things. And secondly, Powers always build from New York City, and you could kind of hear a New York accent trying to come out, but he's able to contain it a lot better than somebody like Brooklyn Brawl, who's like, blah, 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 you know, all like that. So back to Jose Luis Rivera. And Lord Al earlier talked about, I want to know what these guys' motivations are. Are they motivated by glory or fame or money or what is it? All I know is, when I was doing my job interviews last summer, I'm glad that this question was not really asked of me, because why would I be involved in accounting and mutual funds and all that? Yeah, I'm pretty much in it for the money. That's what I would have to say. I mean, there's no other way to put it. I'm not in it for fame or anything that you could, you know, for like professional wrestlers would be. For
you. It's a little everything, you know. You got the side of the money, it's a good pay. Mm-hmm. And side of the victory, if you get some victory, that's the glory. Everything include everything together. So.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Brooks, what's your motivation in terms of
strictly money? Always money.
Strictly money.
Absolutely. What else is there? Money, championships.
You don't get a certain.
You gotta have a little bit more of a drive from inside.
Well, you know, your drive don't seem to be doing you too good, partner. Oh. You know, I think y'all just sit on the end down there and be quiet.
I admire your honesty. Hell, I like you. You can come over to my house and fuck my sister.
This almost feels like I want to give Rusty Brooks a hug and say, "Oh my God, did we just become best friends?" with that answer. But by the way, it should not go unmentioned here that Jose Luis Rivera, what he's wearing, he is like unbuttoned to the navel. I don't know what that dude has got against buttoning his shirt, but clearly he is DTF, okay? And if you don't know what that means, just go ahead and look that up. But Rusty Brooks, like the undisputed super heavyweight champion of TNT for all time, because he managed to bully the other guys getting in that shot at Jim Powers at the end, basically yelling at Jose Luis Rivera because his English isn't all that good and he's a little too quiet. He writes an angle for a Pedro Morales program just when he's returning. Now, of course, didn't go anywhere because clearly Rusty's going into business for himself here. I mean, why don't you just go out there and go off? So he did, and apparently, well, who knows how anybody felt about it, because hardly anybody's going to ever talk about this or remember it. And he also said, maybe Bobby Heenan should take me on as a protege because I'll lift up his program. Oh, ah, oh, the chef's kiss to Rusty Brooks for this segment. So Lord Al, he's got to go and point out the obvious that Rusty Brooks is a little bit too overconfident and that Jose Luis Rivera is a little bit underconfident. But when Lord Al says something like that, oh, you're overconfident, do you really think that Rusty Brooks, the super heavyweight champion of TNT, is going to just let that go by unanswered? No, he's going to book an angle with Lord Al Hayes now, too.
Seen you wrestle. I don't think you got much room to talk. I remember you.
Well, your career doesn't say much for itself right now.
I'm doing just fine. I'm just a step away.
All right, just
time will tell.
Just a step away from stardom, perhaps, as far as...
nothing.
It is just a step away.
Guaranteed.
What an absolute tour de force Rusty Brooks was in this segment. I rank it right up there with Bad News Brown's six-minute bit on the Arsenio Hall show in terms of just how much I love it and how much I will revisit this. And, oh, it is so damn good. Rusty Brooks is my new hero and role model.
Reggie, I guess you represent the old guard up through the ranks, one of the Iron Men of the Federal League. You've been playing pro hockey now for how many years?
Quite a few, aren't you?
Is that right?
I feel that's an appropriate prologue for act number 3 of this edition of TNT. It's from the movie Slapshot. If you're not familiar with it, Reggie Dunlop, played by Paul Newman, is an aging player/coach who eventually resorts to goonery or has his team goon it up in order to score some victories in the Federal League. Well, here, these guys were not winning so much, but they were not complete zeros in the ring. These are older guys with more experience, just like Reggie Dunlop. We got Charlie Fulton, a veteran of WWF television for several years by this point, the unpredictable Johnny Rods, and the Duke of Dorchester, Pete Daugherty. And I'm not even going to try to conceal my accent when talking about that dude. Now, as expected, Rods gets the top chair, and it's well-deserved because he kind of is more of the Vince Sr. era, where he would be that guy that would have matches to kind of test newer talent. One that I've referred to on many occasions is January 1980 at Madison Square Garden, Johnny Rods versus Kevin Von Erich. Now, Kevin was known for being a bit stiff in world class later on, you know, during the glory years in the 80s down there. And that match with Johnny Rods is certainly very, very interesting. But Rods is not in the WWF very long after this. He definitely is a creature more of the Vince Sr. regime, and then he would become a trainer extraordinaire. So he, and since I've commented on the wardrobe for all the guys before, should mention that Rods looks like he's going to go out with Rivera and Mancini later, because he's kind of dressed in that same vein. Charlie Fulton, who, by the way, gets the third chair furthest away from Vince, he's got to sit next to Lord Al. I don't know exactly what he looks like. He might be a Doobie Brothers understudy. Not entirely sure. And the Duke of Dorchester, Pete Daugherty, he's just dressed up very oddly. He's actually very nice for him, but I caught he appears to be carrying something that is going to come into play a little bit later. Now, Johnny Rods, known as the unpredictable Johnny Rods, a nickname that prompted my neighbor in sophomore year at Boston University, he bought a wrestling poster just because it had the unpredictable Johnny Rods on it, and it had a picture of Rods doing that weird classic wrestling pose that you never see dudes do anymore, where they got like their hands up like in like a claw position, like they're ready to engage in some amateur mat work or something to that effect. Like, you'd never freaking see Seth Rollins doing that because, well, all right, I trashed Rollins enough last week. I think I'll cut him a break. So, how do you get the name the unpredictable Johnny Rods? Well, in reality, his name is John and his last name is Rodriguez, so you just shorten that down to Rods. But the unpredictable part, I love how he kind of makes Vince look like a dick on this.
Do you know who gave me the name Unpredictable?
No, I haven't a clue. Who gave you the name?
You don't know. You did.
Really?
You didn't even know that.
But that is you, Mr. Rods, is it not?
The one and only.
Well, I mean, do you calculate maneuvers ahead of time or
No, I just play him by whatever comes in that ring. That's what I'm going to do. And that goes with the opponent they give me. If he's rough, I'm rough. Whatever he's got, I have. Whatever happens, that's it.
Yeah, apparently Vinnie Mac has reached the point, like me on this podcast, where I can't exactly remember everything that I've said in the past. Like, I've probably given derisive nicknames to guys and just kind of forgotten about them over time. But yeah, okay, so the unpredictable Johnny Rods, because he has a very diversified offensive skill set. I'll go along with that. And Rods seems like the coolest guy. I know I just declared Rusty Brooks like my hero of all time, but I have to admit that Rusty Brooks was a bit of a bully, and that would probably wear on me after a while. But Johnny Rods, I could see going down to like a saloon or a bar, feel like a guy who would definitely have my back, and he would just be chill, you know, have a few drinks. Now, on the other hand, on the flip side, my man, the Duke of Dorchester, Pete Daugherty. Vince turns to him, and I can't believe he turns to the Duke of Dorchester, Pete Daugherty, and says, "Oh, you're much more predictable." Now, how is that possibly true? Now, Daugherty is, to my mind, like the flea market version of Terry Funk. Like, yeah, sorry, we can't get Terry Funk, but flea market version. Like, you can get Daugherty for about 50 cents to a dollar. Tops. If Terry Funk cost you, I don't know, 30 grand. Like, that's what I'm saying with that. Now, he had a run in the 70s as the Golden Terror. He was under a mask, so he's a little bit pushed, but kind of a local legend in the Northeast, particularly in Boston. He actually picked up a victory over Haku. This was later in the 80s. I don't know what Haku did to deserve that, but what can I really say? Daugherty, if you've watched any Houston footage from 1987 where the WWF was taping those shows down at the Sam Houston Coliseum, I think it was. I don't think they had moved to the Summit by that point. But Daugherty was on the announce crew with Mike McGurk and Bruce Pritchard, a rather odd team, which probably was not made any better by Daugherty because he was trying to heal it up, but his voice was just very annoying. And when the Boston accent starts annoying even me, I mean, you know that it's bad.
Pete Daugherty, generally speaking, you're much more predictable. I mean, we can look at that kid.
I am not homicidal, suicidal, or psychotic, McMahon.
I don't recall anyone stating that you were, Mr. Daugherty. I just meant you are more predictable in terms of...
I am unpredictable. I'm just as unpredictable as Johnny Rotz and Charlie Fulton right here. I'm the Duke of Dorchester, by the way, too. Whenever you introduce me as the Duke of Dorchester. I work hard for that title, and I want it.
The Duke
of Dorchester? The Duke of Dorchester, baby.
You earned it already.
I came all the way from the dukedom to get to here.
Mr. Daugherty, get a hold of yourself.
And you call me.
I got a hold of myself. I am not suicidal, homicidal, or schizophrenic. I'm just as sane as he is, and a guy on the end.
Thank you.
Geez, so I guess that's where Bill Alfonso came up with the tagline for Sabu: homicidal, suicidal, and genocidal. Of course, the last part wasn't part of Daugherty's bit, but yeah, wow, Pete Daugherty was Sabu before Sabu was. He's certainly playing up the accent. He's making no effort to hide it, as I have tried to do for the last 3 years. Now, Dorchester, you might be wondering, it's actually a part of the city of Boston. I mean, you may already know this just through Pete Daugherty. And out of all the neighborhoods in Boston, as a city that's not exactly known for its peaceful racial integration, it is a very segregated city, I have to admit. However, Dorchester, out of all the neighborhoods in Boston, is probably the most diverse section between white, African-American, Latino, Asian. You have a pretty good mix there. And a lot of celebrities, both good and bad, have come out of Dorchester, Massachusetts, even beyond Pete Daugherty. I mean, we got Kay Hanley, Letters to Cleo, Whitey Bulger, So you got that on the bad side. Ray Bolger, who I think was the Scarecrow in The Wizard of Oz. And my mind is blown that a guy named Bulger and a guy named Bolger came from the same place. On the bad side, though, we have all the Wahlbergs, which I know it can be a little hit and miss with that. But, you know, I was actually watching a little bit of Shooter last week. And, yeah, I really just need to sit down and watch that entire film because it's a masterpiece. Come out of retirement for one last job. That is one of the all-time great tropes in any movie. That will immediately get my attention. John and Jordan Knight of New Kids on the Block, although you may know them as NKOTB, but I am not fooled. Leonard Nimoy, who's Spock in Star Trek, of course, and Houston Texans head coach Bill O'Brien. So a lot of people come out of Dorchester just beyond Pete Doherty. It's also the home of BC High, Boston College High School, the third best school in the Catholic Conference, well behind Malden Catholic and coming in just behind St. John's Prep. So Charlie Fulton, you're probably wondering, he's just hanging out on the end, not saying anything. And he doesn't even get to talk before his match comes on, which is him against Barry Windham. And this is actually kind of an older one, trying to track down when this would have aired. It is from the November 17th, 1984 edition of Championship Wrestling. It starts with a front face lock. And Fulton does get a few right hands in, but then he gets caught with, like, I describe as an uppercut off the ropes. I'm not sure exactly what to call it. Dropkick off an Irish whip by Barry Windham, who Mike Rotundo is not there yet. So Windham is just there as a single, and he follows that up with the Bulldog to pick up the three count. So Charlie Fulton is not a guy that I've ever thought of with any huge outsized personality or anything. He was just kind of a guy who was on WWF TV and did his job, no pun intended, and was on his way. Now next, Pete Doherty, of course, is a much more memorable figure. He was on the first Saturday Night's Main Event of all things, which aired about a week after this, as I mentioned in the intro. And he is facing, in the match here, Superfly Jimmy Snuka. And putting a date on this, I was left scratching my head because Mean Gene Okerlund is on color commentary with Vince McMahon. So this is really, really old because Gene last did color on Championship Wrestling in June of 84. I think they were still in Allentown at that point. But We start with a headlock by Snuka into a head scissors by Doherty and a slam and a falling headbutt. But then Snuka goes up for the second rope headbutt, and that is how he picks up the three count. I thought that this might be from the St. Louis tapings, but I really could not find where or when this match would have been. But not the last time those two guys were on opposite sides of the ring for reasons that I'm going to get into because Doherty, trust me, he has plenty more to say coming up. Now, Johnny Rods, his match, we're going to get a really high-profile one from January 19th Championship Wrestling. Johnny Rods against Hulk Hogan in what was a non-title match, and Hogan is in the blue with the white knee pads. Now, the clip of this match with Hogan delivering an elbow was in the intro to Primetime Wrestling for many years, in 85, I think all the way into 1987, which where it really starts to get odd seeing Hogan in the blue trunks. Hogan grabs an arm and starts working it, I guess proving the point that you can take the boy out of the AWA, but you can't take the AWA out of the boy. And Hogan is actually having a little bit of trouble with Rods, who, you know, kind of with his unpredictable offense, a second rope forearm and a falling headbutt, which gets a two count, and kind of a very subtle Hulk up. The Hulk up, as you know it, really didn't start to take effect until 87 when it became a, you know, patented formula, let's say. And the clothesline, the elbow drop from the Primetime Wrestling intro, and then he follows that immediately with the leg drop to pick up the three count. So Hulk Hogan victorious over Johnny Rods, but a solid performance for Mr. Rods. And Rods says that he was really close to being the champ when they go back to the studio To which I want to say, well, the match was non-title. I've seen that edition of Championship Wrestling, and it was a non-title match. You know why? Because they were afraid you were going to shoot on Hogan, that you had decided, you know what? Vince Sr.'s dead. I have no loyalty to Vince Jr. I'm just going to shoot on this asshole, and I'm going to take the world title. So that's why they had to make it a non-title match. Now, Charlie Fulton, I mean, for whatever it's worth, he's going to get a chance to speak, although Doherty is next to him, and he pulls out what looks like something like a kerchief or something. And the question to Charlie Fulton is, what do you prefer, tag team or singles? How actually do you prefer to lose?
I prefer individual competition myself. Just as you seen that match with Barry Windham, you know, it was a give-and-take match back and forth. But you saw as the camera came on, he had me in a front face lock and, what was supposedly a front face lock, but was, more like a chokehold.
It was like a chokehold.
Exactly like one.
I've been on that, and I think it's a chokehold. Yeah. He uses it, he gets the hole out of you, and he don't let go, it comes in, and by the time you get down there, you're choked up, but that's, I don't call it anything else but a chokehold.
See, Johnny Rods is a team player. He's going to stick up for his boy Charlie Fulton and just kind of reiterate what he's saying and kind of give him an excuse for why he would have lost that match. But Doherty, who's in the middle there, he's not just going to settle for being one of these guys. As a matter of fact, the Duke of Dorchester, he's just going to go all Paul Christie on this entire scene. Like, he's not just going to make, snide remarks like Rusty Brooks and just sit there and bully people around. No. What I mean by saying he's going to go all Paul Christie is he is also going to go into business for himself. Yes, I covered the Paul Christie TNT appearance many episodes ago. It was from a Superstars of Wrestling from May of 1986. Do check that out in the archives. But yeah, he is just not having it with this whole scene, and he is not shy about letting everybody know.
If you were really going to show tribute to the unsung heroes of this business, why did you show that piece of junk there where the man obviously cheated?
In terms of your match with the Superfly?
With Superfly, snooker!
He cheated?
And what were you... You've seen it with your own eyes. What are you, blind, McMahon? I'm going back to the Middle East where people speak to me with respect and address me by their proper title.
Which is...
The Duke of Dorchester.
The Duke of Dorchester.
Yes.
And you're recognized as among the royal families in the Middle East?
I am. I was out on a cruise. I went to the island of Falaka.
The island of what?
Falaka.
What country is that in?
In Kuwait.
The island of Falaka.
That's correct.
What is the island of Falaka known for?
It is one of the greatest islands in the world. It has on it the last remains of the Gunga Ding or whatever. What's the thing?
The Gunga Ding.
The Gunga Ding. It has on it digs that are 5,000 years old. What are you laughing at, Chuck?
Only the accent.
Putting out here some real good history here for you, baby, and you got to learn it.
Gunga Ding.
Gunga Ding, the last outpost of Gunga Ding. On the island of Falaka.
Island of La Falaka.
You got it, Jack.
Well, I've never been there. But if you said...
Well, a man of your caliber would never ever make it there.
Well, perhaps...
You have to have a little class, address people by the proper.
Perhaps everyone should tour the remains of Gunga Ding.
That's correct.
We'll be back with more TNT. Stay with us.
I'm not exactly sure where Doherty was going with that. That kerchief that I referred to, he turned it into some sort of head covering that he utilized when he started talking about Falaka, which, by the way, you can't spell Falaka without fail, which I guess is appropriate for this show. That is an island off Kuwait that is basically kind of a getaway location, it seems, for residents. The population is only 147. That's the number as of 2011. The Iraqi military went and they expelled the residents and mined those beaches in 1990 and 91 during the invasion of Kuwait, and then Allied forces finally expelled them from there. Seems like a cool place with antiquities and all that other stuff, but entirely random that Pete Doherty would bring up Kuwait in the year 1985. Well, as it turns out, And these have been posted on Twitter more recently. The WWF had shows in Kuwait in that 1983-84 neighborhood. I think there might have been one tour in 83 and one tour in 84. Anyway, the results of these shows have been very hard to come by. However, there is somebody who I believe is from the Middle East who has been posting matches from 83 and 84 onto YouTube that took place in Kuwait, which is just fascinating to see. Which led me to my next question. Where is Pete Doherty? Well, how does he fit in all of this? Did he actually go on one of these tours? Did WWF actually fly him to Kuwait and, you know, put him out there and be like, yep, this is the best we have to offer? Or however you want to put it. Well, as it turns out, well, I reached out to coordinating producer, emeritus of Greetings from Allentown, Mr. Richard Land, because he knows these things, and I knew he was going to come up with it fairly quickly. And as it turns out, I had searched on YouTube for, you know, Pete Doherty Kuwait. I did Google searches for any sort of results, and I couldn't find anything. But Mr. Land told me that it was the person who's been uploading these, uploaded a match that is labeled Jimmy Snuka and Gama Singh, which is labeled Jama Singh. I'm not sure if I have that incorrect or whatever. That team took on Big John Studd and blank. The person did not write in the second name. They just wrote Jimmy Snuka and Jama Singh versus Big John Studd and then there's a dash and it says Kuwait City 1984. Well, that person was actually Pete Doherty, and the person probably did not know who that was. As somebody in the comments actually pointed out, Pete Doherty is Studd's partner. So he has, in fact, been to Kuwait and apparently has been saving up some sort of comedic rant to do for 2 minutes on TNT. And there's obviously footage of the match, but they didn't see fit to put him in the title. So I don't know really what to say about what Doherty is doing there. I know y'all are sick of Boston and Boston sports, and yes, I can appreciate that. We're all sick of Bill Simmons. You're all sick of the Wahlbergs, as I alluded to. But sometimes it's best to just let those Boston dudes talk themselves out. I mean, eventually we just fall asleep or pass out drunk, what have you. I mean, God knows that this podcast is probably just going to end with me passing out. I don't mean this episode. I mean, like, the entire Greetings from Allentown series. I'll get to, like, episode, you know, I don't know, 278 or something, and I'll just fall asleep, and you'll never hear from me again. So, you know, let us talk ourselves out. That's the strategy I have at Bruins games when somebody is being overly obnoxious in the first 5 or 10 minutes. I just assume that they are inebriated, and eventually they're going to tire themselves out, and they're going to be tuckered out, and they're going to get a visit from the Sandman later. And I don't mean the blonde guy from ECW. I'm talking about the guy who puts you to sleep.
For the benefit of our unsung heroes that have joined us thus far here on TNT, we have a little bit of a surprise and a special little something for them. We will be joined with them in a most unusual cafe. With that in mind, let's take you to the MC, if you would, Mr. Howard Finkel.
Thank you very much, Vince, and welcome everybody to the Café Le Bump. And now, let us have a warm TNT welcome for Crusher Comic.
There's still about 7 or 8 minutes left of this show, so we're going to go over to a different set where they set up Café Le Bump, a very cheeky name if there ever was one, a comedy club where we're going to be visited by the masked Crusher Comic. And before I get into that, I have to admit, I love seeing Howard Finkel at any point where it's not in the context of just him ring announcing, like him running a comedy club. Like, and imagine like the open mic night for Howard Finkel where you go there and it's he does that like 20-minute thing where he's explaining the rules. You know, when the light goes on, you have 30 seconds to finish up. Like, I could just picture Howard Finkel running an open mic night, like explaining the rules, just like he would do at the Royal Rumble, or just like the referees do when an NFL playoff game goes to overtime with two of them this past weekend. It's kind of funny. Like, I always want Howard Finkel there for any sort of rules explanation. So this Crusher comic is, I don't know who it is. There's nothing saying, oh, it's Steve Lombardi under a mask. I mean, I made that assumption, but I can't confirm that it's actually him because all the guys who are on the show are in the audience, but I never saw Lombardi, so that's why I'm kind of figuring it out from that. This Crusher comic, no, this is not the Crusher doing airline peanuts jokes, like the actual Crusher and, you know from WWA and from Milwaukee and all that. No, it's not him. It's definitely not him. I have no idea who this is.
How you doing? Hey, let's play Stump the Van. B flat. How you doing, guys? How you doing? It's good to be here at the Cafe Le Bump. I'm a little upset because when I was real young, my father left me, and I've been looking for him ever since. Has anybody seen this guy? I gotta know. I'm looking all over for him. Welcome to the Cafe Bump. We're getting a giveaway tonight for you, Mr. Predictable. They should call you Mr. Predictable because you always lose. No, I'm kidding. Hey, come on. I don't need this. We got for you guys.
Johnny, baby.
We got it's a nice outfit there, Johnny. Someone is a Volkswagen going without seat covers. We got souvenir matches tonight. There you go.
Ah, what a bummer.
There you go. I've been all over the place. Bummer. I've been shopping. Ah. I've been shopping at the TNT gift shop. I just got a Rowdy Roddy Piper Rubik's Cube. I got it down to 4.5 minutes now. Why don't you try it, Duke? Wait, I'll mix it for you. Give it a try. Hey, Duke.
Now, I know what you're thinking. None of these jokes make any sense with just the audio. Yes, indeed, he is a prop comic, which I guess was pretty in vogue for the 1980s. Does not do well for audio. He said he was looking for his father, but it was a guy with a picture of a guy with an identical mask. So, haha. But, I mean, like I said, there's 7 or 8 minutes left of this show, so he's just going to keep rolling.
Hey, Johnny, look what I got. Puerto Rican Hot Wheels. You guys see WrestleMania? Mr. T? You guys never got the shot at him. You guys are the unsung heroes. But I got him here tonight. Look at this. A Mr. T Cabbage Patch doll. I pity the fool that adopts me. I pity the fool. What else we got?
Oh, look
what I got. I got a pair of 3D sunglasses. I don't use them at the movies or anything like that. I use these at home in bed. See, my girlfriend's Jewish, so I just put these on. It creates the illusion of movement.
I don't know why he's picking on the Jews. I mean, first they came for the Jewish women, and I said nothing because I was not a Jewish woman. I mean, come on. I remember being told a story by Keithy that his mom once said that Jewish girls give the best. Oh, wait, I probably can't say that. I can't say that. No, absolutely not. But this Crusher comic, the problem with him is, you know, this type of humor, it runs out of steam pretty fast.
Hey, it's good. No, you guys, let me just tell you guys, it's all attitude. I mean, you got all the headliners here, you got your Orndorff and stuff. Let me tell you something about Orndorff. He's not what you think. You think he does well with the woman and stuff. It's not true. Last night he was involved in a menage a trois. Well, actually, it was more like Paul and two mirrors. And you got, hey, come on, I don't need this. Come on. How about Hillbilly Jim? Hillbilly Jim, he's not as smart as you think. Pretty naive sexually. When he was young, his father was explaining to him the birds and the bees. He told him, Jim, the men go on top and the women on the bottom. So Jim bought bunk beds. Think about it. Anyway, look, you guys have been great. I got another job. I work part-time as drama coach for Lord Alfred Hayes. So I got to be off on that job. Hey, we'll see you again. You guys are great. Take care. Come on, we'll see you.
Now, just when you think we're free and clear of Crusher comic, we get the little blurb on the screen as they go to commercial. It says, we got more of the Crusher coming up. So, oh, great, when he comes back. So, I don't know. I mean... how can you really follow the great Rusty Brooks and the madness that is Pete Doherty?
Hey, please, take care of the staff here. Our waitress here at the Cafe La Bump really works her butt off. In fact, if you look at her, she's been working here so long, she has no butt whatsoever. How you doing? Hey, remember, guys, remember, it's all attitude. You got to get in shape. You got to work hard. Rusty, not many people notice. You got to get in shape, Rusty. That's the problem. You're out of shape. Did you know he started out as an actor? When he was young, he did a horror film called I Was a Teenage Warehouse. Rusty's the only guy I know. The only guy I know with a zip code, E-I-E-I-O. Hey, just kidding, Rusty. Just kidding. How you doing?
I love that Rusty makes sure to get in the last word. Like, you better be kidding. You can hear him in the background. Why did they give us more Crusher comic if he walked off stage before? Anyway, I guess they had to fit in the commercial break somehow. So now we're going to turn it over to Mario Mancini, the 18-year-old Das Wunderkind, before Alex Wright was ever around. I don't know what Das Wunderkind would be in Italian, but in any event, he is going to play Rock'em Sock'em Robots with Crusher comic, and I'll give you one guess how it ends.
Who we got? Mario? Sure, why not? Come on up. Give him a hand. Mario Mancini.
Oh, give him a hand. Oh, Mario Nello.
Slam him down.
How you doing?
Take him in a bow. Hey, Mario. Shut up. Hey, Mario. These are
kind of... You might have two.
Yeah. What living proof that cousins marry, huh? Right here. These lapels are a little wide. What did you need? Runway clearance to get here? All right. How we doing? All right, what we're going to do is we're going to do a little demonstration here, wrestling. I'm going to give you a chance. I saw the clips before, your matches and stuff. And what have you ever been involved in a chain match?
No.
Okay, what we're going to do is we're going to have a chain match like you've seen many wrestlers do. What happens here, Mario, is I fasten myself.
Hang on, Mario, hang on.
Yeah.
Tighten it up, Mario.
And what you do is you go to this. Unfortunately for you, Mario, you don't benefit from a collar like I do. But that's like
watch him, Mario, watch him.
Hey, hey. Right. Please, Mario. All right, Mario, hang on. All right, Mario, we'll do this no problem here. There we go.
Mario,
all right.
Get your first win.
Not a chance, Mario. All right, now what I need you to do is sort of initiate the action here, and then we'll get into the fight.
You want me to make the first move?
I want you to make the first move, all right, Danny?
Kill him, Mario! Knock him out! Yeah!
Oh, that makes me mad,
Mario.
There's only one way to settle this. Sock'em robots to the finish. All right, Mario, this is the way we're going to do it. This is the way I like to do things. Mario, go. Come on, Mario. Come on. Come on, Mario. Come on. Mario, you didn't have a chance. I glued my guy's block down with crazy glue.
Yeah, a lot of enhancement guys over the years have been involved in chain matches. But poor Mario Mancini, he has to do the job in freaking Rock'em Sock'em Robots because Crusher Comic actually cheats him out of it. But it was a lot. I think what made this tolerable, at the very least, is the guys in the audience heckling with Doherty there, Rod's chipping in, of course, the great Rusty Brooks. So, I mean, you know, I'm not going to give this segment an A++ or anything like that, but, you know, it was definitely passable. And as I said, it's really hard to follow the comedy that is Rusty Brooks and the Duke of Dorchester, Pete Doherty. And that'll do it for WWF TNT for May 3rd, 1985. Now, in other podcasts, he does not have a new show in the past week, but Mr. Steve Bennett of the Sportscast is probably drowning his sorrows after yet another excruciating New Orleans Saints playoff defeat. I mean, they've had probably the worst run of playoff losses that I can remember, where just heartbreaking one after the other, all in extremely different ways, although I think they got pretty fairly beat this past week. So do check out Steve Bennett and the Sportscasters on whatever podcatcher application you might be using. Now, on the Our Vantage Point podcast, Joe Morata and Michael Quinn, they're on episode 160 this week, so they're 10 ahead of me, and their salute to mid-carders looks at Owen Hart, who, you know, I think of as very much at the tippy top of the mid card if you're going to put him there. But Owen Hart, I was thinking about him the other day, and just in terms of, I like to think of wrestlers as like for calendar years that they have as like a wine vintage. And for my wrestler wine rack, I love a 1994 Owen Hart. It pretty much goes with anything, whatever mood I'm in. It's just wonderful. Now, on the Wrestling Podcast About Nothing with Mike Crockett, Brian Malonis, and Brian Fury, they look at the biggest busts in pro wrestling history. And I was thinking Lady Blossom, Deborah, but they're actually talking about stuff like the Lex Express, so completely different than where my mind went. Now, do give a 5-star review on iTunes for all those fine podcasts, as well as Greetings from Allentown, because it provides what is known as social proof that you are listening to and enjoying this particular podcast. It is always greatly appreciated. What you probably do not appreciate from me is if you actually took my gambling advice for the NFL playoffs last week, where I posted it on Twitter, and I can't even like give the surgery excuse for it, but I went 0-4, and not only that, in my other pool where you just pick straight up winners, I went 0-4 in that as well. So I don't even deserve to have music when I pick the games this week, which is pretty much going to be simple. The favorites in the AFC and the underdogs in the NFC: Baltimore -9.5, Kansas City -9.5, Seattle +4, and Minnesota +7. Why? Well, Seattle +4, I feel like they always play Green Bay tight. I think that the two games in the AFC are probably going to be blowouts. Even though Tennessee were able to run the ball against the Patriots, it's not like it translated into a lot of points. I can't see them getting to 20. Baltimore's probably going to put up their typical 30. Kansas City is going to eat Houston alive with passes over the middle. It's going to be a Travis Kelce type game. Now, Minnesota, that's the game that I'm least confident in, but it just strikes me as a game that'll be close, and San Francisco will, in fact, pull it out at the end. So I'll just take the 7 points. But on that wins thing, I'm actually going to purposely try to pick losers because I want to see if I can go 0-11. Because you got to figure, that's just as hard as going 11-0. It's not like I'm going to win it now anyway, since one person went opposite me and went 4-0. So enough of all that. You know, as I'm taping this right now to just, you know, kind of give you a peek behind the curtain, that it's 10 o'clock on Wednesday night. Dynamite has just ended and NXT has just ended, and I completely forgot to put it on mute on the TV. I usually like to have it on and muted, and they had the Salute to Memphis Wrestling this week on AEW, and of course, I forgot to DVR it. Yet, I can remember to DVR The Good Place like 9 days beforehand. I'll set up the recording because I'm going to miss it live tomorrow night. So, clearly, I'm just despondent about all of that, so I am going to get out of here. But next week, I'm probably going to do a WCW show. I think that's overdue. It's been 10 episodes now since I've done that, and that one had freaking Oz in it. So I'm going to just surf around and see if I can find something that is to my liking. Maybe it'll be late-era Crockett or that weird period where it's not quite WCW, but it's after the Turner buyout where it's just sort of NWA, should be 89 or 90. So do stay tuned on social media at GF Allentown Pod, which is where I would generally post it, on Twitter for all of that information. I again thank you so much for listening, and tune in next week, next Thursday. Yeah, that's the day that I actually do the show. Yeah, for another exciting episode of Greetings from Allentown.
I'm doing just fine. I'm just a step away.